This episode brought to you by Origins, technology for today's lenders. On the show today, we have a global fintech influencer, Mr. Chris Skinner, on the program. He's not only a global fintech influencer, he is an author, a speaker, a blogger of thefinancier.com, and he has a new book out now called Digital for Good, and this is speaking the credit union language of people helping people, or banking for social good. So be socially good and help out not only folks, but help out the planet and so many other things, financial inclusion. Yeah, he covers it all here. So a great, great conversation with Chris talking about his new book, Digital for Good. So check it out. Hey, everybody. Mike Clausen here with CU Broadcast. Welcome to our show. And we have a very special guest on our program today, Mr. Chris Skinner, global fintech influencer, author, speaker, blogger of thefinancier.com. So Chris, thank you very much for joining us today. We're excited to have you here.
Mr. Lawson, thank you for inviting me. And it's nice to see you and CU Broadcast.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. So the reason why we have you on today, not just because you're an all-around cool guy and you know a lot about fintech, obviously, but you have a new book out called Digital for Good, and really excited about this new publication. And so just to kind of kick things off, can you give us a quick summary on your new book, Digital for Good? Because it sounds like the angle here is kind of like financial institutions they got to be like socially good as well as, you know, serving folks out there in a financial way. So can you give us a quick summary here?
Well, I've written many books and they all seem to have the theme of digital somewhere in their title, but from different angles, about financial inclusion, about how to transform a traditional old bank into a cool, hip digital bank. This one took a different angle, which is basically that there's so much discussion around environmental, social, governance, ESG, and green climate emergency, biodiversity issues, that I found a lot of companies that are starting to use finance with technology to make the world a better place. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's a great platform for exploration. So this book is all about that, which is how can we use finance and technology to make the world better?
Indeed. And as I was going through a lot of this, going through notes and stuff like that, I was constantly thinking, gosh, you're really talking the credit union language here, because credit unions obviously are very socially conscious. They really get into the communities and really help out, and they do so, so much. So that was personally, that was a very big interest for me. But this one's a bit, like you alluded to in your previous response, it's a bit different from your previous writings, because this is more of a collaborative effort with folks from all over the globe, where you're working with folks. Some of the chapters are basically interviews. You're kind of co-writing some chapters with folks out there. So why did you go down this road as opposed to just a Chris Skinner book, so to speak?
Well, a number of reasons. The main one, I guess, is that if I talk about how can we use finance and technology to make the world a better place, and it's Chris Skinner's talking, I didn't think that was a great thing, because it sounds like I'm the preacher on the pulpit talking to the unconverted. So I reached out to friends across the world who I knew had an opinion about these areas. And it doesn't just talk about ESG. It talks about purpose-driven banking, transparency, the whole idea of financial services being built the wrong way and what we need to do to make it the right way. And the contributors are everything from new banks and challenger banks and neobanks in Europe and Africa, through to venture capitalists on West Coast America, to visionaries in South America, and actually quite a few people involved in financial inclusion in African nations, mm-hmm. as well as across Asia and China. So it's a world view. You know, there's over 20 people who contributed to the book via interviews or writing chapters or working with me. And I just wanted it to be in the round. I didn't want it to be Chris Skinner's telling you the world can be better with technology and finance. I wanted everybody to understand it.
And it's great to get that variety as well, because you get so many different viewpoints and so many different angles, and it all just kind of collects into this one great theme here about just, you know, this socially good movement, so to speak. And that kind of brings me to my next question here. And your book's mission, so to speak, is if your business doesn't stand for something, it will fall down. So can you expand on that thought for a couple of minutes here?
Well, this particularly appeals, I think, to the credit union marketplace, because
right.
when I look at the traditional large banks, I think they've lost their way. Anyway, I'm not clear on what they stand for. I don't know what their purpose is. And my contention is that if you don't have a clear purpose, then you fall down because you've got no value sets or direction mm-hmm. that guides you. And this actually was bubbling away in the 2000s, particularly in 2008 when the financial crisis hit in Europe and America. And the chair of the financial regulator in Britain said banks have lost their moral compass and a lot of what they do is socially useless.
Right.
And that kind of stuck with me because it was saying, you know, how can banks be socially useful? Because that's what they should be.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're socially useless and all they do is deliver profit for shareholders, is that the right way to run a bank? Is that the right way to run an industry that's actually essential to the economy and to government? So a lot of what inspired this came from 15 years ago and what's been going on for the last, you know, over a decade, and saying we need to have companies involved in finance that are not just delivering profit for shareholder, but delivering return to planet, return to stakeholder.
Yeah.
So that's the main contention, which is how can we have a financial system that delivers the benefits to society and community and the planet, as well as the shareholder, which, as I say, I think probably will resonate very highly with your listeners.
Mm-hmm, indeed. And also we hear, I mean, I've read study after study about how the younger generations, the Gen Zs, the millennials, are very into mission-driven companies as well. And banking would be no different. If, you know, if they're going to be banking at, you know, ABC Bank or ABC Credit Union, you know, they would be more apt to join or do business with somebody who has a deeper mission as well. Is that what you're hearing out there as well?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. And I spent quite a bit of time looking at Gen Z or Gen Z, depending on where you come from, and millennials and their voices. And they are very clearly articulating that they want the world to be a better place. And yes, they might buy into climate emergency, ESG, et cetera, et cetera. But from my side, by way of example, I'm neither of those generations demographically.
Yeah.
I'm a bit of an old guy, but I have a huge passion for biodiversity and for wildlife and the animal kingdom.
Yeah.
And so I don't care if climate is destroyed, to be quite clear. And in fact, I got into quite a few arguments as I developed the book with people who are climate deniers. They deny there is a climate emergency. I don't care. What I care about is over half of the world's wildlife disappeared in the last 50 years because of the destruction of the habitats that they live in. That's what I care about.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone will come with a different agenda. And I think particularly Gen Z and millennials have a clear agendas themselves about what they're passionate about. And if they don't feel the organization shares that passion,
yeah,
then they don't want to be with that organization.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that thought process kind of percolating to throughout every generation. I think it's kind of a generation or demographic agnostic, I guess, if you will. I mean, I think more and more people are caring about what's going on out there. And you mentioned the climate emergency going on here. So one of the questions you ask in the book is how purpose can impact a bank's role in the climate emergency. So can you expand on this one as well? Because there's a really good example that you gave as well about Poland and its coal production as well. So I really thought that was that hit home pretty well. So can you expand on that one?
Nice to know you've been doing your research.
A little bit.
So we all would say there is an issue with the climate because of the science. Even if you deny this as an issue with biodiversity because of the science and the habitat of our worlds. But the reason I picked on the Polish example is because I live there. So that kind of makes a difference. And Anna Botan, who's the executive chair of Santander Group, a huge global bank based out of Spain, was being interviewed on Bloomberg. And she, I thought, made a really good point, which was you cannot just switch off coal overnight in Poland because Poland depends on coal energy for its power. And that's the national infrastructure. It's not like just one little house down the road. It's like the whole of the country.
Right, right.
So you've got to have a plan. You've got to do it in a transitional way in which the industry can make the move to renewable energy. And for, you know, banks like Santander can help to make that happen. But first, it's not going to be overnight. But second, it's the banks that will actually influence us the greatest. So by way of example, you know, there's only 100 companies that generate over 70% of the greenhouse gas emissions destroying our planet. And they're the fossil fuel companies, the Exxons and the Shell and BPs of this world. And what we have to do is to use the financial system to encourage them and incentivize them to change. And since the Paris Accord of 2015, through to the end of 2021, the top 60 global banks made $4.6 trillion of investment in those companies and that in those industries, because that's how they make profits. You know, it's basically supporting fossil fuel firms to do more fracking. And I don't want to frack the planet, excuse my French. I want to make the planet safe for my kids and my my grandchildren. So the financial industry is at the heart of this. And if you can use that $4.6 trillion over the past 6 years to say, we will only lend you money in the future if you're doing good for the world, then that's going to be a massive change. And in fact, one of the features in the book is an interview with Extinction Rebellion. And the co-founder of Extinction Rebellion, which is an activist consumer group, said, we don't mind investment in fossil fuel firms, but we just want you to know there should be no new investment in fossil fuel projects. And that's the subtlety.
So what would incentivize a financial institution to go down this road to address one of their major customers, you know, an oil production or an Exxon or a Mobil, something like that? What would incentivize a financial institution to do that besides saving the planet? If there wasn't
funny enough, I'm just blogging this week. I've just written it, Michael, but it'll be in my blog in the next few days about make my money matter. And there's a movement, and there's a lot of consumer activist movements, but this one was started by Richard Curtis, who was the guy who directed Four Weddings and a Funeral and Love Actually. He's a great sort of comic director, but he also founded Comic Relief. And he's also co-founder of Make My Money Matter. And what this movement is all about is saying the pension funds hold the key, which is, you know, they are managing trillions of dollars in investments. And if they say to the asset managers, the fund managers, the financial institutions, we don't want you to support anything related to you know, fracking or arms, terrorism, then that influence is huge. And in fact, it resonated with me because I was at one meeting where we were talking about responsible banking, which in some ways is an oxymoron. There was a pension fund guy there, and he said, my biggest concern is I'm running a pension fund and I might not have customers to pay a pension to in the future. And that statement, that literally that statement hit me in the face. And I was like, geez, you know, I don't want my kids to go and live on Mars. Elon Musk might achieve that vision, but I want them to have an Earth that they can enjoy.
Me too. And another example that you used in there, and it came from all of places, China. And this one, I nearly fell out of my chair when I saw this one. China planting trees and through an organization called Ant Forest. And I thought that one was really fascinating because it all had to do with, you know, using finance to do good in society and the planet, sustainable economy through a sustainable finance. So I thought this example in China was very interesting. You want to share that one real quick?
Yeah, there's actually two or three examples like this now. The first time I encountered it was with Ant Group, which is a sister company of Alibaba. Which is it's like the Amazon of China. I mean, they're huge. And one of their staff came up with this idea that maybe we could use the wallet, the electronic mobile wallet for payments, to encourage more sustainable behaviors. So if you cycle to work or walk to work, instead of getting a taxi or taking your car to work, then you get points. If you buy recyclable materials and don't get plastic, then you get points. And what do points make? Prizes. And the prizes you get to invest win the planting of a tree.
Yeah.
And then it became a multiplayer game. So you can steal points off other players in your social community.
Oh, right on.
And they've now planted gazillions of trees across China.
It's amazing.
Which has changed that world.
Yeah.
And I say they're not the only one, because there was another great example. I tried to get them to participate in the book, but the timing didn't work out. But Arlandsbanken, which is a Finnish bank, is doing exactly the same thing with credit cards and debit cards in the Nordic community, where every time you do something that's more green in your behaviors and based on how you pay and what you're buying, the more points you get, and the more points you get, the more they invest in renewing the Baltic oceans in the Nordic region. And in fact, they've now white labeled that, and it's used by over 100 million people worldwide.
What?
So, you know, these things are happening, and finance sits at the heart of all this, because the way in which you change people's or companies' behaviors is by rewarding them and incentivizing them with good behaviors and punishing them with bad behaviors.
See, this is such a great message for credit unions, again, because it really hits home to their mission as well. So that's why I love your book big time. And the other one I wanted to dive into real quickly here, because I know you don't have a whole lot of time, but is talking about financial inclusion or the unbanked. And which is a big deal in credit union land right now. And in there, you say that banking creates an equity divide between those who use it and those who don't. And I'm thinking or those who can't, you know, so because we have these things called banking deserts and stuff where people, there's just nothing there for them. So anyway, but you gave the example about how India has really turned around their unbanked, because India went from 35% banked to 80% banked in 6 years. Talk about financial inclusion. So you want to comment on that real quick?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen this in China, in India, in Africa, African nations. Just to be clear, Africa is not a country; it's a continent. I've seen so many examples where digital is allowing an identity to exist, which people didn't have access to before. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you can be identified, then you can be included. And that's a huge thing. And so what happened in India is the government in the mid-2000s rolled out a big program called ADHER, ADHEER. And it was basically a biometric recognition system of people across India, most of whom, or many of whom do not have the ability to sign or read in the way in which we do because of education.
Right.
But when there's 1.1 billion people who want access, as soon as you give them a biometric onboarding that's government identified and recognized, then they can move into the financial system. And that's why that statistics is gobsmacking,
it's
35%,
amazing,
82% in just a few years. But I've seen the same in many other countries. And in fact, one of the interviews I did in the book was with the founder of Monzo, which is the UK challenger bank. And their mission purpose is to make sure that finance can include everybody. And when I was talking to Tom about how they realized this vision of, it should include everybody, that includes homeless people. How do you include a homeless person in financial services when they have no fixed abode?
Right.
Well, if they have a guarantor who does have a fixed abode, that's such a simple answer.
Yeah.
And yet how many of us actually think that way, behave that way?
Exactly. It just takes execution, doing it. An idea is nothing until it's done. So yeah. So
a bit like Nike, just do it.
Exactly. Exactly. What could be more true than that? Hey, before I let you go, I have to have you comment about the latest developments in cryptocurrency, because that's included in the book as well. So can you share, I mean, this could be a whole show unto itself, Chris, as we both know. but can you share with us what your take is on this volatile space right now? Cause it's quite the roller coaster.
So today there's over 10,000 active cryptocurrencies. And as soon as I say that, I go, geez, we don't need 10,000 cryptocurrencies. We need one. or maybe two or three.
Right.
Because they have different constructs, proof of stake or proof of work. So Bitcoin, Ethereum are the main platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Will they be in a decade? I've got no idea. But what I do know is you cannot have a global network without a global currency. And that's why this is really important.
Yeah.
And the global network does not recognize borders and countries and governments. And this is the big concern for the Federal Reserve or the Treasury, the Bank of England, which is how can you have currencies and value exchange systems that exist and they don't recognize that we exist?
Mm-hmm.
But they exist.
Right.
Tough. You got to deal with it. So you don't need 10,000 cryptocurrencies, but we do need one or two that allow global network exchange securely and with trust. And we're not there yet, but you know, by the end of the 2020s, I think we'll have a couple. And more than likely, they will get some form of attachment to national governments, probably in the cash-in, cash-out moments and phases. And that's pretty easy, to be honest, because you can do that today. But it's just not worked out yet. And as for the crash, it's a crash like this, you know, every few years,
mm-hmm.
and then it comes back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you may say, oh, Chris, you know, this crash is the crash of crashes. It will never come back. I guarantee you it will.
Oh, I think so, too. I think this is just what many are calling a check. So it's a big check, but I think you're
only Americans use checks.
That's right. I haven't used one in, I don't know, last time I wrote a check. But anyway, so this is great. Chris, I could talk to you all day long about this type of stuff. And I know you have a busy, busy schedule. So we appreciate your time. And the book, again, is called Digital for Good. And it's on Amazon or wherever. We'll put the link in the show notes so people can get right to it. But yeah, this has been a thrill. And anything else to add to wrap up here? Any final thoughts on your book and what's going on the planet?
Not really, apart from you know, I'm always looking at the next thing and the next thing that's happening. And I guess right now the fintech community is going through a huge rationalization because of the recession. You know, this is going to be a tough year or a tough few years. And what will happen is a bit like the dot-com crash,
mm-hmm.
which some of us may be old enough to remember 20 years ago.
Yep.
We're going to see some amazing companies that come out of this stronger and bigger. And actually, I wouldn't be surprised if we see some banks being acquired by fintechs.
Interesting.
So watch out for that.
Okay.
I think there will be a lot of banks that are also going to be buying fintechs too.
Yeah. All right. That's today's hot take. All right, Chris, thank you so much. Appreciate the time as always. And congrats on the book. Again, we'll put the link in the show notes so people can get right to it and go buy it. I highly recommend. So highly recommend for sure, especially credit union folks, because this is speaking your language. So anyway, again, Chris, thanks again. Appreciate the time and keep up the good work there. All right. This episode brought to you by Origins, technology for today's lenders.